Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Kara Swisher, editor-at-large of Recode. You may know me as Vox Media's CTO, which stands for Chief Tweeting Officer, but in my spare time, I talk tech, and you're listening to Recode Decode from the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today in the red chair is Nicole Wong, the former Deputy Chief Technology Officer of the United States. She served under President Obama from 2013 to 2014, but before that worked for Google and Twitter in very critical positions. I've known her for a long time. Thank you, Nicole, for coming on to Recode Decode.
I'm delighted to be here.
I have dragooned you here because there's so many topics that you are an expert on, and you've been inside the belly of the beast, you've been outside in government, that there's a lot of things we've got to talk about, everything from election issues to content moderation to what these companies are doing to the legislation that's maybe coming for these tech companies, probably not because Congress is a bunch of idiots. That's my opinion. So let's start first by talking about your background so people get an idea of where you've been.
Sure.
So you started, you're a lawyer.
I'm a lawyer, Richard. You know what? When I was growing up, I wanted to be you, Karen. I wanted to be a journalist from like the time I was in sixth grade. And I ended up going to, I only applied to law schools that had joint law and journalism degrees.
Oh, so what
I
have happened?
I had a graduate degree.
Did you work for the school newspaper and things?
I did the school newspaper. I was an intern at the Anchorage Daily News.
Wow.
I did bear stories.
Wow. Okay. So you're from Alaska?
No, I'm from San Diego.
Okay.
But like that
you
was
went
where I
there.
Did my internship.
Okay.
At the end of it, I kind of decided that actually law was going to be more
yeah, because we're useless.
Me.
You got that? You figured that one out?
I just, like, something about, like, tactics, like, the law part appealed to me. But I ended up doing First Amendment law when I came out of school. So the first part of my career was representing newspapers, TV stations, radio stations in the Bay Area on First Amendment issues, which was fabulous. Mm-hmm. But in the mid-90s, my—
Give me your biggest First Amendment. What was your—
I worked on—I don't know if you remember when the Ninth Circuit ordered— They reversed the not doing the death penalty in the United States, or in California, excuse me. And so we did our first execution in, I think, like 1994 in California. And then there was a case in California where, like, we were going to do an execution at San Quentin, and the afternoon paper, the San Francisco Examiner, got locked out. And so we went in and made the case that if you don't have an afternoon paper, if that execution happens overnight— No one's going to know about it the next morning because of the way print cycles worked, before the days of the internet. So that was one of the cases I worked on. A lot of them were small. A lot of them were like, we need access to that courtroom. We need access to public records. Some were defamation cases. Some were libel cases. Some were reporters privilege cases. But like in the mid-90s, those newspapers started going online. And then the partner that I had, and I've like followed them there. And in 1997, we started getting our first pure play internet clients. And so Yahoo was one of the first clients. Some that you wouldn't remember, maybe like Silicon Investor. But Hotmail, before it was acquired by Microsoft, Netscape.
So you worked for a lot, yeah.
A bunch of them, right? It was such an exciting time to be both in the Valley, but also a lawyer where the law was still unclear. So that's how I got into that. In 2004, I left the law firm, went to Google.
So why did you do that? A lot of people have done it. A lot of people haven't.
Yeah.
I know lots of different lawyers who have done that and moved along.
Yeah.
But you were covering lots of tech companies and startups and making law, like really, because a lot of those deal making, there's all kinds of different legal issues to deal with.
So the thing that I most enjoyed about counseling clients was actually helping them build the products. And so when we first started presenting Yahoo, they had only two lawyers in their legal department, neither of which who had a background in sort of publishers' responsibilities and rights. During that time, and I think a lot of people forget, a lot of the folks who were moving onto the internet thought of themselves as software developers and didn't appreciate their role as publishers.
Right.
And so
they still don't, Nicole.
There is that. Yeah. So there's like consistency. Although I think they've gotten better in a lot of cases because they talk about issues.
Nicole,
of free
they're
expression.
Not media companies. They're platforms that deserve the immunity. I've sat with them.
We're totally going to get to that, right? But I think a lot of the work that I was doing at the beginning was helping those companies appreciate what it means to be a message board, and it's not just software, right? It has responsibilities to the people who are on it and to the people who read it. And so that was a lot of the first part of my work. But I missed, I think I recognized as a lawyer, and especially when you're the outside lawyer, that you don't get to have say on the design of the product. Mm-hmm. You don't get to have say about, like, what is the business responsibility around this product? And that you get by being in-house. That's
right.
How you get
right.
to the table. So.
Yeah.
I had an opportunity to go to Google in 2004.
Small. Still small.
Yeah. It was like 1,100 people, I think, when I joined. They hired me as senior compliance counsel, which we immediately changed to, like, product counsel. Mm-hmm. Because nobody invites the compliance guy to
meeting,
right?
I can be compliant.
But if your job is styled as, like, I'm here to help you get your product out the door, then you're in the meetings.
And making it legal to do so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So you worked on what? Talk about it.
I was responsible for the launch of all of our products globally. Mm-hmm. And so in 2004, it was just search. But after the IPO, it very quickly became much, much more than search, right? Street View was a big thing. The acquisition of YouTube, the acquisition of DoubleClick, all of those areas that Google started to grow in over the next 7.5 years were the things I was involved in. I grew up a team of product counsel with my good friend Alex McGillivray, and they went on to do amazing things. And then some of my responsibilities expanded. So I had responsibility for, at various times, litigation, patent, trademark, copyright, privacy, and broad regulatory type stuff.
Which grew and grew and grew at Google.
Which kept growing.
Right. Right. Which was because Google moved into more and more things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what was the thinking at the time about lawyers? Like, they just wanted to make and not think, if I recall. But they did have lawyers around all the time.
They did have lawyers. And I have to say, like, I think my experience was, like, the lawyers who were there at the time, Kulpreet Rana, David Drummond, Alex McGillivray, Miriam Rivera, we were all really good at finding the place where we could add value and be valued by the client, which is the thing that you have to do. Like, you can't be the lawyer that says no all the time. You have to figure out a way, not this way, but what if we designed it a different way?
Right.
And I think that's the part that made it the most fun, which is, like, how do you figure out how to achieve the business and the product ends while being legally compliant.
Right. But you never got called a compliant anything after that. So you were there for how long?
7.5 years.
7.5 years, which was this big go-go days, really,
it was,
for Google.
Yeah. It was all of our big products. It was in and out of China. It was lots of new possible business areas that we then closed down. We had, I don't remember, like, Orkut, the social network.
Yes, I remember Orkut. I know Orkut. I just ran into him recently.
Yeah. So, like,
he's
right.
still bitter that he's not Facebook.
So
big in Brazil. I'll never forget. It was Larry or Sergey. He's like, it's big in Brazil. And I'm like,
right?
So what?
I was like,
but the rest of the world, not so much.
Huge,
like,
in Brazil, India, and Iran.
Right.
And no one in the United States.
They kept saying big in Brazil. I'm like, you keep going with Brazil. I'm sure you'll somehow catch Facebook with that. I'll never forget that, big in Brazil. So you then went to Twitter then.
So I took a year and a half off to hang out with my kids and my family. And then at the end,
what got you out? Why did you leave?
Part of it was I was ready, and I had a team that was ready to take on the responsibility. A lot of it was, I don't know that I've ever said this to people who were not just friends. My youngest daughter one Christmas said to me, I was like, what do you want for Christmas? And she said, more time with you.
Oh, wow.
And there's only one answer to that.
Right?
It's like every working mom's nightmare.
Yeah. But
I was able to do it and totally enjoyed the year and a half. And after a year and a half, my daughters were literally like, what do you do all day?
Yeah, right.
And I was like, all right, so it's time for me to go back to work. So I went back. I went to Twitter to work with
How did you get there? What was the...
Alex McGillivray was the general counsel, and he and I had worked at Google together, and it was a pleasure to work with him again. And it was the job was to build up their product counsel team.
Right.
And so I was there, but I was there for literally, I think, 6 months before I got a call from the White House to join the Obama administration as the deputy CTO.
And why did you want to do that?
You know, I think...
policy, right?
Part of it, and part of it super personal. So they had actually caught me right after my grandfather had passed. And mm-hmm. he had instilled in us the sense that, like, you have every right to be here. Mm-hmm. And you have a right to participate in your community and your government. And if you get the opportunity, it's a responsibility mm-hmm. and your privilege to do so. And knowing that, when the call came in from the White House, there's no way that I can't walk that walk, right? And so the opportunity to serve, and candidly, and I don't know if you know Todd Parkwell,
yes,
he's phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And the vision that he had for bringing all of government services up to another level mm-hmm. to be able to participate at such a high impact. That was huge, and right. wasn't something
And you
I
focused
could turn
on
down.
What there?
So my portfolio was innovation, internet, and privacy policy.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of big.
Huge. And yeah. like when you go into government, they tell you like
fix the government.
Right? Don't break the internet. They tell you like focus on three things. Like you got to have three priorities because every day is an emergency and you're mm-hmm. going to get distracted if you don't. So going in like April, I was, like, getting ready to move, and I was like, where are the kids going to go to school? And I was like, okay, so I'll do maybe internet governance and free expression, which is sort of where my passions lie, and maybe I'll do some privacy. And we were planning to move in July of that summer, and June 9th, mm-hmm. if you remember, is when the Edward Snowden disclosures
yeah.
started.
Yeah.
And they were like, how soon are you getting here?
Right.
So I started the next week.
Right.
And honestly, like, the first half of the time I was there was spent on privacy, surveillance issues, and most importantly, I think the work that I'm most proud of was public policy implications of big data.
Right, right, which has been the story ever since.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it was interesting. I was writing a column today for the New York Times that I write for, and one of the things that I left out was the damage that Snowden thing did to the relationship between the government and Silicon Valley, which
yeah.
had been relatively cooperative until then. And then it was broken rather.
I think that's right. I think, like the notion that I would go and talk about internet governance or free expression mm-hmm. at a time when like mm-hmm. the Snowden disclosures happened,
yeah.
like that was done.
They've
like you weren't going to talk about
you.
Anything
you've
else.
Been spying on us.
Exactly.
And, which I think was, you know, which the government assisted the government, the companies were cooperative with. They said they were not. It just went on. It just seems like a lot of what would happen in the Russia thing, you can draw a very bright line, is that they were not cooperating in the way they used to.
Yeah.
In the way they used to, which is interesting. But that's a topic for another day. We may get into that. So you did that. And what was the experience like? You're in the middle of that. That's all there is. That was
yeah.
all there was.
Yeah. No, right. it's all-consuming. It was fascinating.
Right.
Like, there's no other experience like it.
What did you take away from it?
The most important lesson, and the one that I continue to try and work on, is I think that we have not done a good job of filling the ranks in government and in the public sector with
yes.
technologically capable, savvy people.
Or they're in a backseat position.
Exactly.
They're brought in like the help.
They think that, like
the air conditioning
you're there to fix the email servers, right?
Right.
As opposed to, like, thinking about forward-thinking policy
mm-hmm.
and the ramifications of what it means to use all this technology in our world. And I think we are doing ourselves a disservice
mm-hmm.
by not doing that. I think that there are big and small things that I've been talking with people about, like what should be the tech agenda for social impact.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is government. Part of it is like just make shit work,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
Like if you can order a chocolate cake on
yeah.
Amazon and have
yeah.
it delivered that
yeah.
day, then you ought to be able to get your Social Security benefits just as easily, right?
So absolutely.
Like there's that. And then there's the broader vision, which is like, what's our moonshot,
mm-hmm.
knowing what all of our capabilities are? How mm-hmm. do we power the next?
Why is that from your experience in government? I have some thoughts about it, but I mean that they just don't think about it. They're not technologically literate people, for many of the people that go into it, and they operate in a very old system that resists that kind of change. And also they're fearful of it and wary.
Well, because they don't understand it very
right.
well. Right. So there's some wariness. I think that's going to change over time. I think that the growing ranks of those at the staff level and at the congressional level are much more savvy
mm-hmm.
than they used to be. If you even just look at not all the questions in congressional testimony
right.
are great, but they're way better than they were five
okay,
years ago.
If you say so. Zuckerberg ones. I was literally
that's
like
they're reading
the
Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
Yes. But like they're way better than they once were. And
mm-hmm.
I think we're getting better at educating them. I think that, you know, we still face a lot of competition. If you're coming out of school with a CS degree, are you going to a private company or are you going into the public sector?
Right, you're not going.
And there's a money thing,
no, yeah,
right?
Right.
And we haven't instilled in people the sense that they should serve.
Right,
like,
for
that this is our government,
right.
and it's only as good as we are,
right.
and they should serve.
So you were there for a couple of years
uh-huh.
and then came back.
Yeah.
So what have you been doing since?
See, I knew you were going to ask me that, and I wish I had a really crisp
driving
answer.
Your daughter's crazy.
I know, exactly.
Mom, please leave. Are they teenagers now?
They are. They are
leave.
Both in
yeah.
high school.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah. My son left the other day, and I haven't seen him since. Like, he was like, bye, Mom. Like, I'm like, where'd you go? And
it's
he
an
showed
amazing
up again for
time.
Lunch.
Yeah. I love them both dearly, yeah. and it's an yeah. amazing time. So, yeah, so part of it is being home. Part of it is I consult for some companies. Mm-hmm. I do some work with nonprofits like mm-hmm. Mozilla Foundation, which is doing a lot of work mm-hmm. on the area of internet health.
Right.
Witness, which is a human rights organization that mm-hmm. was founded like 25 years ago by Peter Gabriel to do. It focuses on training people to do video documentation of human rights abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And in this era of everybody has a camera.
Right.
Right. And you can use this data in so many new ways. Just thinking, forward thinking about that has been a real joy to work with them. Some of it is literally still supporting folks who are in government
mm-hmm.
and giving them some right. guidance and trying to get more people into their ranks. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then and working on other things. What was really interesting is Nicole sent me a whole list of things to talk about when she was here. She thought I prepare for these shows, but I don't. I'm like, my whole life is preparation.
Give me something to focus on,
No, I don't.
On,
that's my thing. I don't help you. Someone on Twitter today was like, what do you prep these people? I was like, I don't prep anybody.
I will vouch for you.
So one of the in the next section, I do want to talk about a lot of things. You brought up a lot of things. What's going on? What's going right now, tomorrow, is there's going to be hearings. This will mm-hmm. appear after that. More hearings for tech things. I'd love to talk about that content moderation, Russian interference, techlash, diversity in tech, tech in the social sector, and stuff like that, which we need to talk about when we get back. But right now we're here with Nicole Wong, the former deputy CTO of the United States. She's also worked for Google and Twitter in some very important positions. We're going to talk about all those issues and more when we return.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
In a lot of ways, the leader of Canada is not like the leader of the United States. Justin is 52, Joe is 81, but the two do share some struggles. Trudeau's been in office for a while, he's being challenged by a conservative populist, and he's struggling in the polls, especially with young people. But now, he's got a plan to fix it, all of it.
Among the $52.9 billion in new spending,
he's proposing a $23 billion program to get nearly 4 million homes built between now and 2031.
He's got a budget that speaks directly to millennials and Gen Z, or Gen Z as he calls them, and he's hoping it'll keep populism at bay in Canada too. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is going to join us on Today Explained to tell us all about it. Today Explained, Vox's daily news podcast, Monday through Friday, in your feeds.
We're here with Nicole Wong, the former deputy CTO of the United States. She's also been a very big executive and important person in formulating a lot of legal issues around tech companies. And there's so many topics we have to talk about, Nicole. I think we're going to start with this, what's going on right now in Congress. I want to get to the wacky stuff at the end, the content moderation, things like that.
Okay.
But let's talk about the Russia stuff,
yeah.
because that's what Cheryl and Jack are there to talk about. And they're going to talk to a chair from Google, some Google chair. Why didn't Google just drag Larry or Sundar there? You
know? I don't know. I don't have any reason to believe they have something to hide.
No, I know. Yeah, why?
Can they just
put them on one of the Google rockets?
Google Time, whatever, the
machine, the transporter.
Teleportation.
Teleportation machine they've got in the back there and just move them on over.
Yeah.
Not Larry, because you got to get him out of cold storage for a while and heat him up and stuff like that. But you don't have to say
Sundar.
Anything. Yeah, Sundar. You know what I'm saying? So they're going there, not Google, but they did, Kent did some
Oh, did he submit testimony? I haven't seen it.
They don't want it. They don't care. Yeah. I don't think Warner's like, screw you. Like, you either show up or you don't. And they're going to have a wooden chair there, apparently. That's what they tell me. So talk about the implications of this. These hearings, I think, are actually more important because they're actually, they're serious politicians who actually know a few things about things. Or
I think that's true. But I think it's important to think about, like, what are hearings good for and what are they not
right.
good for? And I've done, like, five, mm-hmm. right? So hearings are super good for putting executives or companies' feet to the fire,
yes.
right?
And that's always a good thing.
It's always good. And educating the policymakers and mm-hmm. their staff, mm-hmm. as well as the public right. about a thing.
Look at
right?
this.
And so, like, educating, like, Russian disinformation campaigns, that's good for all of us. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. an important reason yeah. to have them there. It's good for, again, like, holding them to a schedule. So my assumption is if Jack and Cheryl are showing up, they have some good news to report, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they've made progress. Since the last
right.
hearing that
so
they
what
did.
They want to do is say, here's what we did wrong and here's what we're doing
and
to fix it.
And here's what we've done to fix it. And right. that's also, like, that's a really good, knowing that they'll be held accountable, that's a good function of a congressional hearing. What I think it sometimes get used as is a platform for assigning blame, mm-hmm. a platform for a political grandstanding. Mm-hmm. That's unuseful. And anyone who thinks someone's going to go in there like, we found the silver bullet, mm-hmm. that's so not going to happen because mm-hmm. this problem is so complex mm-hmm. and so beyond just what the tech companies can do, mm-hmm. right? Like, any expectation that that's going to happen, we should kill that part now.
Right, right.
Right. But to me, optimal results would be that you find some agreement about what's the easy stuff, mm-hmm. Alex Jones, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Find the easy stuff and decide we have agreement on how we're going to handle that easy mm-hmm. stuff, mm-hmm. whether it's by legislation or something else. And then lean into the hard questions, because there's lots of hard
right,
questions.
Right, right.
And figure out, like, what can we make progress on, even mm-hmm. if imperfect? What can we not, that this is not a tech company solution, it's a different solution.
Right. Right. Now, this has been a relatively new thing for tech. Now, Jerry Yang did go and get yeah. his head handed to him during
that. Called a moral pygmy.
Moral pygmy, if you recall.
I do.
I remember saying, don't go. I'm going to do something bad to you there. And he's like, what? I'm like, no. Just, there's no winning on this one. He really did screw it. Things going on there. This was in China. But it's been very little. I think Mark was the first really big, correct?
CEO level, yeah.
CEO
that's
level
probably
big
right.
names. Because most of it has been, I think Jerry Yang was the last one I can remember that was, what else did you...
I don't know. I got sent out a lot.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but not.
But yeah,
not or, that you're not you, big, but
no,
you know what I mean.
No, but totally. Like, you send your vice president of public policy, or you
right.
send your head of comms, or
right.
head of product.
So Mark was the first big one. How yeah. do you assess that encounter? I think it's just the beginning. This is going to go. I was like, strap on your wooden chair.
That he's going to have to do it many
all
more
of
times.
Them, all of them on everything. And by the way, it's not just yeah. Russia. It's going to go to AI. It's going to go to
yeah.
IoT. It's going to go to everything. Everything.
Oh,
cars.
Yeah, for sure. But whether it'll be a CEO or not, I think, is up for debate. And, yeah. and here's the thing is, like, you don't create solutions in a hearing.
No, you don't.
Right? And
right.
so all the hard work and all the commit, you can use the hearing to get a commitment mm-hmm. that something will be done, but you
right.
can't actually devise a solution.
My point being is that these companies have operated largely unfettered
yeah.
for a long, long time. And that's, I mean, they would say not, but I don't know. I think if you were a broadcast company or a media company, you'd be like, hey, get on the legal
right.
train that we've been on for years. So how did you assess the Mark hearings?
How
I thought
he did?
I thought he did well only because they were terrible. That's really pretty much.
Certainly first day.
Low bar.
Yeah. He did worse second day and their questions were better second
yes,
day.
Yeah, yeah,
thought,
for some
right?
reason the house. Yes, I agree. Yeah.
Which, like, 10 hours in that seat, that mm-hmm. sucks for anybody,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I thought he did fine. Mm-hmm. And I thought the thing that I think really kept sort of bothering me during that mm-hmm. was, I think on the second day, and maybe it was because he was a little bit worn down, mm-hmm. he kept referring to AI as the solution. Like, mm-hmm. oh, we're going to start handling this using
yeah.
more AI.
Yeah.
And this notion that, like, we can resolve content and disinformation problems just by throwing some AI about it. AI
yeah.
can help, but it's not going to
yeah.
solve the problem.
Yeah.
And I think that you, if you were not well informed about how AI or just machine learning works, mm-hmm. you thought that was supposed to be a silver bullet, and it's not.
It's not, absolutely.
No. And it could go really wrong, right?
Right?
Like, if we do it poorly,
yeah.
we will replicate all the mistakes we're currently
absolutely.
Making.
Absolutely. My issues with them were the water under bridge. Let's put the water under bridge and let's focus on solutions. I'm like, let's reflect on the problems.
Yeah.
Like, I know you taught that about blame, but I think there's something very good in thinking about why you went wrong.
Yeah. Although, like, I also remember at the beginning of... Mark, I think, said, we accept responsibility for...
We have a broader responsibility.
Yeah, but there was also, like, it was as if he accepted the outcomes of elections both here and in Europe mm-hmm. as, like, Facebook had That was Facebook's issue. And it's not. Like, let's not, you and I may end up disagreeing about this. Like, the way this election turned out is not because of tech or Russian disinformation. Mm-hmm. We had 63 million people vote for a man who was blatantly misogynist, racist, anti-Semitic, intolerant, like all of those things. And he wasn't hiding it from us.
Right.
And 63 million people didn't find that disqualifying.
Right. Absolutely.
So, like,
I agree with you. I just literally made that argument. I actually agree with you. Someone was like, we were talking about talking to Bannon. I'm like, Bannon has got him elected. Like, that's what you need to vote. Like, no amount of amplification by the media will make it any worse or less as he did it, which is interesting. But I see why people are offended by him, obviously. But one of the things that I thought was interesting, though, even though 63 million people did, it's where those edge cases where things could have shifted differently.
The few
I think
where
we will never
thousand.
Know that. I think that's the problem, is there is no way to trace it anymore.
Yeah.
There's no way to find it. It's almost like an episode of Scandal. It's like you're never going to figure it out.
Yeah.
And so I think that will haunt this entire election process, because it's never going to be known if there was 50 ads that changed everything or not.
Right.
Or not where that could have gone. Or you could also blame it on six things Hillary Clinton said that could have shifted it, too. The deplorables thing didn't work very
well.
Or
how it echoed into the media.
Right,
and all
exactly.
Right, there's like a
or was it
huge
the New York Times writing this? Or was it James Comey? Right. There's all kinds of ways. But there's definitely a place for Facebook could have been one of the shifts.
Absolutely. Right. I think that's absolutely true. And I think, like, figuring out how to, what is tech's role, right, for the coming election, especially we're less than 100 days out now, right? So, like, what is the role? That's super important. But I just didn't want to lose sight of, like,
no, I get that. But I do think the three things for them are, one, clean up the fake accounts, which they let grow rampant because they wanted growth. Fake accounts and anonymous accounts, like, that we can't track in any way. Two is clean up transparency in political ads. Mm-hmm. They just didn't do that. They just didn't do their job. That's it. And they should be they're transparent everywhere else. They should be transparent there. And the last thing is the fake news, the allowance. Again, the sloppy management of fake news.
Yeah. And I think in that first category, I don't know if you were including, like, the use of bots.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think these companies ought to be labeling bots.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I should know if I'm interacting with a human or
that's
not a human.
That's right.
And I think that that's not just like a bot, but like a robot.
Right.
Because I think Google did like a demo of its new voice, like human voice.
Yeah, it was
super convincing and eerie. Mm-hmm. We should know that we're not interacting with a human being, because, like, as we go forward and as this human-like AI becomes more and more prevalent, there ought to be a clear understanding of when I'm dealing with a human and when I'm not, when I have to care about the response.
But that's
from
called
the
anticipation. You're anticipating.
Yes.
Let me just say, tech companies did not anticipate
that's
any of this stuff, and they didn't anticipate, and they were sloppy. Those two things are enough to, like, fix that, please, which is interesting. So these hearings, what do you expect to come out of them? Like, because there's one in October about antitrust. There's one later in the afternoon tomorrow, which will already have been news, with Jack Dorsey by himself around content moderation.
Right.
So let's talk about that one. And then I want to know what to expect, actually. Content moderation, which is a nice way of saying censorship or possibly not, or First Amendment.
Yeah.
You're a First Amendment lawyer. How do you look at this incredibly fraught situation?
Super complicated.
Mm-hmm.
No silver bullet.
None.
And I think I'm somewhat frustrated by the level of conversation in each of the countries that is trying to wrestle with it, because they are all dealing with it as if it were not global, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so,
explain that.
Facebook's in this really awkward position where it's trying to have a global platform and one set of rules imposed consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that, like, every understanding of content is incredibly nuanced from a perspective of, like, what it is in the culture, what it is in the political system, how the legal environment handles a content problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know what they're trying to do, and I understand that that's the only way to scale it.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's really hard. And I will say that as someone who gets to say that in hindsight, because I'm not that decider anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And in the days when I did it, it was millions, not billions of users, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was hundreds of, I don't remember, it was like in the tens or scores of hours per minute on YouTube, not in the hundreds of hours of content on YouTube. And so I actually had the time to say my folks would level up something for me to see and I would get a day, right, to sort of think about it and get some more information about, like, well, what does this mean in India, right? What are the ramifications? And to touch base with people in India to say, like, should I do this or that? They appear not to have that latitude anymore.
Right.
And what I'm hearing is that they have, like, 4 or 5 seconds per piece of controversial content to make a decision.
Right.
you are going to get so many mistakes.
Yeah.
Doing that.
And it's the life they chose.
It is the life they chose.
And the billions they accepted.
So the question is, like, do we want to slow that down?
Yeah.
Is this the moment where, like, we have kind of like a slow food movement for the internet?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
we just
a great idea.
Slow everything down.
Yeah. So and how does that work?
Well, so here's, I was thinking about, and I'm not sure I'm going to directly answer that question, but like, when I first started at Google, I remember having conversations around the pillars of design for search. I don't think they called it exactly that, but it was like the principles on which you design search. Mm-hmm. And it might have been Matt Cutts that said, like, there's comprehensiveness. We want all the information we can get. Mm-hmm. There's relevance, meaning we deliver the right response when someone asks a question. And speed. Those were the three pillars of search. And then, like, in the mid-2000s, when social networks and behavioral advertising came into play, there was this change in the principles that we just weren't as concerned, I think, about search anymore. And instead, we were focusing on this other part of the platform. And the dynamics were around personalization, which is not relevance, right? It's not
it's what you
want to see. Not what meets your, answers your question, but like what's more stuff that you like. Mm-hmm. Personalization, engagement, what keeps you here.
Right.
Which today we now know very clearly
it's
the most outrageous thing you can find,
right?
And speed, right? So speed's still there, but the first two have changed, and that has, I think, propelled
this crazy
environment that we're in now. So what if we change the pillars again? What if now everything that we've learned in the last 2 years, we say, that's not the internet we want to live with?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is just personal for me. Like, what if the pillars were accuracy, authenticity, and context?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and maybe that slows it down, right? So maybe that means that things like Black Lives Matter or Tahrir Square have a little bit more trouble getting off the ground quickly, right? Maybe the Ferguson thing, you don't hear about that as fast as you do now and as quickly among
Which
your
some would
groups.
Say is a terrible thing.
Right? So some things are going to, there's going to be cost to like refocusing those principles, but is maybe that's a different world that we actually ought to be trying to build.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think they're thinking about it like that?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I hope they are.
Yeah, I don't think they are. Unfortunately, I think they've got their hair on fire is what the Englings put out the hair, right? I mean, what do you make of the Jack will be in front of the House members who will only talk about diamond and silk and everything, like being pushed down. And Laura Ingraham talked about nationalizing Google and Facebook. I know you're rolling your eyes.
Yeah.
I'm rolling my eyes, too. But these are being talked about by people who have serious impact on potential people who could have serious impact.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not taking them. I'm not just going to roll my eyes. I'm troubled by this.
I'm totally troubled. And here's what
I just Google and Facebook do not discriminate like that. I just
no,
they just don't.
Totally not.
PageRank, right?
Yeah,
from what
exactly.
I can understand, right?
It's,
all right.
Like it's algorithmically based, and it is not about like, hey, I like this political decision better than that political decision. Like, no one's got time.
Mm-hmm. Right. So how do you get rid of that if you're the tech companies, besides just saying it over and over again? Without saying you're an idiot, stop.
Yeah,
saying that.
I don't know. And in this environment, and because they are put on their back foot, I think it's going to be super hard. And what that might mean is that folks like me or you or others outside of that environment say, like, hey, that's not actually the thing that we think is happening, nor are we worried about that.
Do you feel there's an actual risk when you have Orrin Hatch all of a sudden, who didn't talk about antitrust, is talking about antitrust, or the president tweeting that Google's trying to skew his search results?
I do worry about it. But I also think that we have to have an honest conversation about what they are looking for, right? Because some of the solutions that I see get bandied about by folks who are not as sophisticated but understanding what's happening, like, well, there should only be verified users on these systems, right? Or we should have these really blunt instruments, and we just don't allow that type of content at all. Verified users, large, blunt instruments of censorship, those are authoritarian government tools, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So at some point, both we and these companies are going to need to stand up and say, like, the things you are asking us to build in service for this democracy are tools that will be used in China, in Russia, in Turkey, in Saudi Arabia,
right?
Like, you appreciate the fact that we are the global platform.
Right.
And
right.
that what we build, everybody will have the right to demand.
Right. We'll get to Google and China in a minute. Because be careful there. So when the Alex Jones thing came about, what did you think? You know, I thought they should remove him.
Yeah.
They removed other people.
Like, how many strikes do you have to have?
Yeah.
Right. Before you get to it. It felt to me like they had to update their policies to meet the level of, mm-hmm. of vitriol he was propagating on the mm-hmm. process.
How would you have dealt with it as a lawyer? They dragged their feet for a while, and then all of a sudden all flipped.
Yeah. I think it is hard. Here's what I think they were struggling
with. Actually, I think they were struggling.
Right, I think they were struggling. And
they were like, those damn Apple people did it before us.
I think part of it is like this notion of like, how do I think about being responsible for understanding stuff happening off my platform? Mm-hmm. Like, how do I incorporate that into a policy? Because again, like we're talking about a scale issue mm-hmm. and I may have, in the old days, I feel like I had to be like in a rocker yeah. with a cigar or something. But like in the old days, yeah, maybe I had a day to think about that, but they don't. And right. so how do you do the diligence of understanding the off-the-site ramifications or of what's happening in or incorporated
what
into your policy?
What would you have done with those? That was
I probably would have done the research to figure it out.
And then
made a call. But like, I also think like I probably made inconsistent bad decisions mm-hmm. while I was there.
That's right.
Like that.
Right.
So your threat
what
is that you will make an
Alex
inconsistent.
Alex Jones call, knowing what you know.
I probably would have removed him earlier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think so. Yeah, because it just got worse and worse, and then you can put
until someone's yelling
at you. So you talk about
this
document called The Cleaners. Explain that. And then in the next section, we're talking about techlash and diversity.
There's a new documentary by two directors from Germany mm-hmm. who wanted to explore. They wanted to explore, like, what is this content moderation industry? And it was born of, I think, research done by a professor down at UCLA named Sarah Robertson. Mm-hmm. So she is the one who uncovered, like, there are thousands of contract workers in the Philippines mm-hmm. cleaning up all of these social media
right.
platforms,
yeah.
right? And making calls that, like, mm-hmm. if we were here in the United States, we might not quite make the same call.
Right.
So this documentary, they actually go back and interview a mm-hmm. bunch of the contractors about what they understand to be the rules, mm-hmm. the decisions they've had to mm-hmm. make on terrorist content, child pornography, self-harm content, all of this stuff. And it's fascinating to hear from the contractor's perspective what they think their obligations are.
And what do they think?
They are trying really hard to follow the rules. They have seconds to mm-hmm. make these decisions on thousands of pieces of content in an hour, right? And they, the interesting overlay to me was like, this is a very Catholic country. Mm-hmm. They bring a lot of their person and mm-hmm. their identity to work with them mm-hmm. about making decisions about this content. And
it's so
when you think about the complexity of these takedowns, right, it is actually really hard to create rules that when an American user posts something that's visible in Turkey and reviewed by a Filipino contract worker, like, what is that, right? Like who's winning in that scenario?
Okay, we should just shut down Facebook. That's really, right? Like, come on, Twitter. Let's just do that.
It's really, really hard.
Let's just, like, go back. I had Jaron Lanier in, and he was like, there's never been a human experiment on this level of people talking to each other in this fashion.
Yeah.
But when you think about the idea of the cleaners is a really interesting one because it's sort of that back room. Like, you don't want to see how it's made.
Right.
You know, my son just got a job in he's a chef and he's young, but he cooks and he's in a restaurant. And he's like, Mom, you don't want to eat there. He goes, you don't eat any restaurants.
How the sausage gets made.
No, he's like, I was really talking about it. It was over a small, like, pickle incident, but it wasn't that bad. I was like, oh, I'd eat there. It's no problem. But it sort of was like when you see how things get made, it's really, and they are trying to rely on AI when they don't even know what that means.
Yeah. I think getting that right is going to be so important.
Right.
I think, so two thoughts on that. One is, when you understand the complexity of this, I think that it is super hard to, like, hold the tech companies fully responsible and insist that they make no mistakes, which I feel like some of the rhetoric is definitely, like, you never get to make a mistake about that piece of content. And that paralyzes a company mm-hmm. that's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah, they're still back on that My Lai, that mask, the Vietnamese picture of the little girl running.
Exactly. And so that's one thought out of that. The second is on the AI piece, which is I do worry, and this might just be rhetorical, I worry about leaders who are saying, we're going to have AI fix that. And they may have just been like, as protection, this is my flak jacket.
Yeah.
This is, like, the machines will fix it. My experience is that you need to see the content. You need to make the moral call on the Rohingyas or the child porn whatever. Because if you don't, you have delegated your morality to a machine, and that is wrong.
That is
that
a
we
really
should not do
fantastic
that.
Point, Nicole. Do you think that they get this now? Because I think they don't want to be seen as media companies. They want to keep that immunity. That's a law. They're not held responsible for it, so it makes you lazy and sloppy.
Yeah, I think they're struggling in the sense that, like,
I don't think that they want to abrogate all of their responsibility, but mm-hmm. they don't actually want to take on all of the baggage that comes with being a media company.
Is that just too bad now? Will they lose that immunity, do you think?
I think it's starting, like the Sesta Fosta thing, right?
Yeah, that was the recent thing
people
around
prostitution. And sex trafficking.
Right.
I think that there are, people are going to start chipping away at it, right? Mm-hmm. I think you were interviewing, was it Warner?
Warner, yeah.
Wyden. It was Ron Wyden. Thinking about like redoing Section 230 about this immunity. So I think that's certainly a conversation that's happening and has been happening for years.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the current designations we give to these companies don't fit.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we need to find a different one.
Yep.
Right?
It may not be media, but it is some kind of media.
But it's not,
but it's still social
just
media.
Platform, right?
Right.
It's not, if they were under the impression that they're just a dumb pipe, that's not it. So, like, somehow we need to rejigger that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're here having a fascinating discussion with Nicole Wong. She was the deputy CTO of America, but she also worked at Google and Twitter in legal positions, but much more than that. When we get back, we're going to talk about a bunch of issues like TechLash, diversity in tech, and tech and the social sector.
This week on The Pitch, would you like fries with that?
People are what make franchises run. The person who knows the business inside and out.
Yep.
Not someone who came off Wall Street because their check clears. Franchairs is the first investment marketplace where people can invest in franchises.
So you said $800 billion is what this market is a year. And hundreds of businesses are actually franchised businesses.
Thousands.
Thousands and thousands.
There are more brands franchised than there are stocks on the NASDAC.
Oh.
You're raising a $4 million price round.
And what are the terms on that?
The $19 million post-money valuation.
And do you not think that the valuation is a little frothy?
This week, things get frothy when Kenny Rose brings a new alternative investment class to retail investors. Go right now and subscribe to The Pitch, wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're here with Nicole Wong having a riveting discussion. I'm having one. I'm very happy about it. About some issues around tech, which are big. Nicole has worked as a lawyer, but more than that, at tech companies like Google and Twitter. And she's also worked for the federal government trying to figure out policy issues. Let's talk a little bit about this thing you called a TechLash. You wrote this, a note to me, TechLash and tech's ethical issues. We were just talking about this. These are ethical issues that I don't think they want to take responsibility for or never understood. I wrote a column, I think, saying Mark never took a humanities course, so perhaps he should have taken one or two. A little Kierkegaard might have done him a little good. But, you know, you have to get, or a little, I don't know, you know, Elie Wiesel, you know, all kinds of things. And he was the one that brought up Holocaust deniers and walked right into a bad bunch of quotes about it. How do you look at this TechLash? Where is it going from your perspective? It's easy, because not just that, but addiction about automation, robotics.
Yeah.
Like, it goes on and on and on.
Yeah. It was funny. I was doing a talk for women in STEM recently. And I was like, I had to do this, like, okay, I have a little bit of imposter syndrome because I'm here as like a former deputy CTO.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, I have like every liberal arts card stacked against me. I'm an American studies major with a minor in English and a poetry fellowship,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I don't cover any of those bases.
Yeah.
But maybe that's actually what tech needs right
mm-hmm.
now is like we need more sociologists and ethicists coming into the tech sector to talk about the broader implications of how tech gets used.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're starting to see that. So like a group that I'm on the advisory board for called AI Now,
mm-hmm.
which is run by Kate Crawford and Meredith Whitaker out in New York. And they are all about what are the social implications of
mm-hmm.
AI?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need more of that conversation. Dana Boyd's Data and Society,
obviously.
Likewise, having these really interesting, like hardcore research on the implications for humans
mm-hmm.
when we use these technologies.
Right.
That, I think, is super important. And that, I think, will help turn the cultures in some of these tech companies around if they're smart enough to grasp.
Are the leaders, you've been close to these leaders, are they amenable to it?
I think they are, but I don't think they know what that role looks like,
mm-hmm.
right? Like,
right.
Where do you put an ethicist?
Well, they never liked the non-tech people.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, they pretend to. They tolerate them.
I know. So I got tolerated at a lot
yeah.
of meetings.
Yeah.
But I think
again.
I think that they know they're missing something,
mm-hmm.
right? All the smart ones know they're missing something. And so I think they are looking to figure out how to put that into the system. But it is a system that's built on very straightforward, fast, iterative development that doesn't necessarily do a lot of stop and think about the human aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
Nor could I imagine a world right now, knowing how a lot of products get launched, that you would say, hey, we shouldn't do that until we understand the ethical ramifications.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Like, I just don't see holding a launch for that one.
Yeah, because you wouldn't get a lot of things, would you?
Yeah. So, right? Like, so I think, you know, if we want our companies here to be super innovative and productive.
Because they're not doing that over in China.
Exactly.
For sure,
right?
And that's their argument.
China's going to sweep the table.
Exactly. That's their argument now, right? Like, when I had Mark in the podcast, he's like, well, it's, you know, if I get hindered, what about China? I'm like, what? Like, that's my choice, is Xi or you? Like, I don't feel like that's the choice I need to have to make.
But I do think, like, thinking through, like, how do we get ahead of the standard setting that China will do otherwise, because they may not be hampered in the
same
way.
Talk about that sweep the table.
So AI is actually the place where I'm like, thinking about this.
Right.
To develop
and surveillance and robotics and facial
data. To develop really strong AI, you need a lot of data. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have an authoritarian government that says, hey, we're now all doing facial recognition, you suddenly have a lot of data.
Right.
Which they're doing
in China.
Right. Which, if you're in the United States or Europe or whatever, you have to get consent. That consent can be withdrawn. Like, all kinds of hurdles to collecting the data, which means we'll be slower. Mm-hmm. I don't have an issue with that, except for the fact that, like, China has the ability to deploy a technology that will simply be the dominant technology if they get there first, right? Or could be.
And what does that technology look like?
Whatever.
Tells you everything.
Right? Exactly. Right. Like this whole, what is it they're doing, your social currency or something like that based on your facial recognition?
Yeah. Like, it was a Black Mirror episode, if you recall.
Like, it's terrifying, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the question is like, well, how are we weighing in on that? Mm-hmm. And can we weigh in if our technology can't meet theirs?
Right, right. So what do we do?
I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, part of me says, well, what if it means that all of the countries who are doing this work need to get together and say, like, this is acceptable use.
Right.
And China's going to be the outlier.
So a cyber doctrine.
Yeah.
What can be used? Ian Warner talked about this in my interview. He said there's a cyber doctrine over what we can do and what we can't do. Mm-hmm. And if people violate it, we will use our tools to stop it.
Right. Which means we need to start using more of our global forums, right, to sort of just make policy
as
decisions.
We did on many other issues,
yes.
Pollution or climate or things like that.
Nuclear warheads, like all kinds of things.
So who's the leader then if we have an administration currently who doesn't have a CTO? I make that note? How do you feel about that?
I'm so sad for that part of our government.
There was a real estate guy there, but he's gone. No, I'm serious. He was. He was very nice.
Yes, he was.
There's nobody there. It's like empty. It's fascinating.
Right? At a time
empty.
When, like, we are...
They actually let me in the White House. I can't believe it. But they do.
And did you, like, steal M&Ms?
No, I didn't. I brought my phone in and taped everything, like Omarosa. But you could, by the way. Let me just... I was such a good girl. I put it in the box and nobody checked it. Like... And I was like, wow, they used to check it. Like, they used to, like, it was really kind of shocking.
I mean, totally separate in part. Like, the internet tech policy issues, which I used to cover, gone.
Right.
Nobody's watching that.
No.
Cybersecurity, gone. No one's there. But honestly, I'm thinking about, like, biotech. Mm-hmm. Zika,
right? Yeah.
Ebola,
yeah.
Climate change. Like, all of these things where, like, there is no
input.
Scientific input.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Much less policy input on what to do about those things.
Thank goodness we don't have a Zika. Like, they wouldn't have. Who would tell them what to do?
How would we know?
How would we know? Which is interesting. There's a new book coming out with Woodward, which is frightening, actually, because they're basically taking paper off his desk so he doesn't see things. But was that a good thing to have a CTO, do you think, or as deputy CTO? Because why?
Because I think you need a voice for tech at the table. And this goes back to where we started the conversation. It was like, technology is not someone who provides your email, right? Technology is actually a moving force,
a bigger thing.
That can deliver services well. But we're not just fixing websites. Like, this is about reaching millions of people, right, to make their lives better. That's where the possibility exists.
100%.
And you want people who are in the CTO's role who can envision that.
Mm-hmm. And give advice in a helpful
and
way.
Have a seat at the table of the president to tell him. That vision exists.
Right. And he would just want you to help him do Twitter, right? Trump, yeah. He does a pretty good job, actually.
He seems to be a master.
He's real good at it. But so getting back, I want to get back to China before we go and then talk lastly about diversity. Google and China.
Yeah.
You worked on the coming out of China, going in and coming out.
Yeah.
Which was it was a big call at the time.
It was. And I think the company struggled with it going in and coming out. And candidly, I would stand by both decisions. I would, to this day, stand by the reasons we went into China.
Explain them.
To make the services more broadly available to a significant part of a population that was, I don't think that Google would have ever said this, but was information poor, right? Mm-hmm. They just didn't have access to as much as you could get. And so even when you censor, and I think that the way that we manage search results, when we knew that there was an area the government would not let us show, we—
Falun Gong.
Right, exactly. But we would show at the bottom a disclaimer that says some results have been withheld because of the government restrictions. But then at least Chinese users knew what they were missing, right? And before, they had no idea. They thought they were seeing the whole world. Mm-hmm. So I think giving them that instinct to have a sense for what is missing was an important—
Okay. Although the government now might let you put that warning on.
I think that's right? Like, so now that we're gone, is that still the way things work? I think that that was actually a really important thing. I also think, candidly, the way that Google—
That's the optimistic—
I know, but that might have been, you know, the time that I was there and the things that I believed in.
But then coming out,
Coming out, like, over the course of the years that we were there, increasingly repressive, increasingly censoring, and then intrusions onto the Google systems, right, by Chinese hackers, all have said, this isn't worth it, right? There's no way we can protect our users and defend our mission with this happening. And so we left.
Right.
And I think that that was the right call, too. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what we did was we left in a noisy way to make sure that people understood what was at stake. Right. I think it's really interesting, right? Like, the questions that I got from Congress during that period were, some of them were around this issue of, like, how can you undermine democratic values by acceding to that government's censorship? And, you know, like—
When you were there.
When we were there. And right now the questions are flipped, which is like, why aren't you censoring more?
Right. Oh, I know, by the same people. For our stuff.
Yeah. Right. And so, like, I think—
You know what I think they're mad about is Facebook has pulled away a lot of political and news stuff and put in more cat videos again. And they don't like
and
that.
And they don't like that.
They'd like—
It's taking time
out. Exactly. But that's my theory. That's my working theory.
So it's like, I don't think it's wrong for that they've changed their focus. I'm saddened that that's the place we're
so,
in.
So,
right,
but what about going now into China? It's gotten a backlash within Google.
As it has
work for the Defense Department, as has work all kinds of things.
So I don't know enough about their decision making around that.
What do you imagine?
I haven't heard
the same
enough
criteria
about, like,
that we're going to help China be better.
Yeah, but I think it matters a lot how.
Right.
Like, I think when we first went in, it was with this notion of, hey, we're going to have disclaimers about what we remove, but it's also we would not have authenticated users in China, so that we would never be in a position of having to deliver a user to the Chinese government.
Right.
I don't know whether that's the constraints, but I would hope that they are thinking through—
Why do they want to go in now? They just can't miss this one, this swing?
Yeah. I mean, like, data, right? Yeah. Huge swaths of data.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree with its value either, right?
Yeah. Dirty data. Sorry. I don't know. I mean, I know it seems like they haven't gotten better. This country hasn't. It's gotten more authoritarian.
Yes.
And so is the rest of the world.
And it's not going to get better.
There's no way they're going to do it. And so they're just going to have to admit what they're doing.
Right.
Right. Which is interesting. Do you think, what changed in that regard? Just we need the data.
I don't know. Yeah. I totally don't know. I will say, like, for China, and I don't know any background to it. So Kai-Fu Lee, who actually
used to work tomorrow. Yeah.
Oh, you are. Yeah. So he used to work for Google, and now he's there. And I think he's been saying some really interesting things about AI and, like, the proper role for AI and the proper role for humans.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that's a more interesting conversation than I'm hearing in a lot of United States.
Yeah.
Right.
There's a lot of cool stuff going on in China at the same time, and I do think they're sort of going to clean our clock in many ways.
Yeah. But
authoritarianism helps.
Yes,
helps to be able to do that. So lastly, we just have a few more minutes. This diversity issue in tech is something you have this group of women, mostly women in AI now, is that right? Or it just happens to be
women? I think it's across the board.
So another thing, California may rule that we have to have so many women on the boards, things like that.
Yeah, super interesting. I mean, like, after I left the administration, the Obama administration, they kicked off an initiative, I think under Megan, right, which is diversity in tech, which makes a total sense. Mm-hmm. I think it was also coinciding with, like, the Ellen Pao case and that sort of thing. So there was a lot of movement at that point. Pinterest was talking about, like, let's everybody publish their numbers, let's put more money into it. And then it kind of all went quiet. Mm-hmm. And then there was Me Too.
Right.
I think that there's been a huge amount of progress by folks. And I know you talked, like, Eileen Lee and mm-hmm. All Rays yeah. and Sikander's board mm-hmm. list mm-hmm. and Megan, because she's in mm-hmm. everything, like, continuing to promote diversity across the board in STEM. I have heard at the CEO and board level that the right questions are now being asked by, mm-hmm. you know, our white male mm-hmm. folks. You know, what am I going to do to change the diversity mm-hmm. equation in this company? That's awesome. And I find myself impatient that it's not happening right. faster.
To finish, make the product case for it, for a lawyer that you want should have this.
Yeah. So, like, I think particularly for those products that are very social, to not have the perspective of women and marginalized people telling you what feels dangerous to me, mm-hmm. right? Or what would I really like to see? You are missing an opportunity. Like, I completely buy all of the data that says the financial performance of more diverse companies is significantly better. I completely believe that because you are actually looking at your user base within your company and having them co-design with you a better product. Mm-hmm. That to me is like, it's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. The fact that we cannot seem to retain those people and get them to higher levels,
Now they're just dragging them in. They're not helping.
Exactly. They're like stuff in the pipeline, right? And so their numbers look good there, but I am still hearing like people are in rooms where they feel like they're alone and they have no voice.
Yep.
Right? And whatever we got to do to change that, we have got to do it faster.
Absolutely. This has been a riveting discussion. Nicole, I'm having you back. You. You're my new Chamath.
That's nice.
That's a compliment. Even though we all know Chamath, it's a compliment in any case. This has been great. These are great topics. I'm going to have you back to talk about more. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much.
By the way, Nicole was pinging me on Twitter, right? Weren't we? And
yes,
I said, come
right.
on the
that's
friggin' show
yes,
and tell
exactly.
me that. So just anybody who does that, except for that real mean person today, that would be
no
great.
No mean people.
No, I'm okay with mean people. I like mean people.
Really?
I don't need any mean people
in my Twitter feed.
I don't mind. I want to talk to Steve Bannon, so what do I know?
That's true. You are a glutton for punishment.
Yes, I am. If you enjoyed the interview as much as I did, be sure to subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also find more episodes of Recode Decode on Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you didn't like the interview, you're an idiot. Or just want to say hi, tweet at me. I'm at Kara Swisher on Twitter. Now that you're done with this, go check out the latest episode of Recode Media. You should find that show wherever you find this one. Thanks for listening to this episode of Recode Decode, and thanks to our editor Joel Robbie and our producer Eric Johnson. I'll be back here on Monday. Tune in then.